Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Radio Show through BBS Radio. It is the 22nd of January, 2011. I maintain a website at www.zeropoint.ca, and I have a wide variety of writings there on mystical teachings and modern science, investigations of what I call the heart doctrine, which is this idea that human consciousness and being existence derives out of the human heart, and that the mind in the head is really secondary to the heart, the self within the heart. And that in modern science, we don't consider a human being as having any singular I or element in them. Whereas in mystical teachings, there's this concept that we have a divine spark or a God spark or a Jiva Atma or a monad. These things are called or described in different ways in different traditions. But the concept is that there is this kind of spiritual self, this spiritual or divine element within the human being. And that's the origin of consciousness and life in the material body. And that in this element, this spiritual element, is embodied in the material form. But at death, it withdraws from the body and it can still exist within other dimensions of being, within other bodies, because we don't simply have a physical body, but we also have subtle bodies. The three lower bodies are considered as the physical, the astral, and the mental bodies. So we as beings are said to be embodied. The most important concept then that I elaborate upon and have explored for the last 30, 40 years is what I call the heart doctrine, that our being self-existence derives out of the heart, and this self pervades the body and spreads its influences through the body, through the blood, and not only the blood of the physical body, but the blood of the subtle bodies. There's a whole inner circulation of light and vitality through the subtle anatomy. And this whole thing, in a sense, originates from a first point. Blavatsky, in The Secret Doctrine, when she draws a circle and puts a point in the center, and in a way that point is like a zero-point center. And Blavatsky is describing how the universe had such a first point of differentiation. And at that point, that's where the finite world emerges out of the infinite root principles of creation. And so the universe has a first point, and it expands within without, like the budding of a lotus. So it grows within without and expands. And eventually Blavatsky describes any living being as withdrawing without within and coming back. And Blavatsky describes the divine mother ingathering the sun at the end of time. And this cosmos, again, is said to go back to a zero-point condition. So this is an ancient mystical concept of the origins of cosmos is from zero-point conditions. And in my work, what I'm saying is that we need to try to understand the psychology of human consciousness and existence in terms of this of a higher dimensional zero-point, in terms of zero-point centers and higher dimensions. In a way, zero-point centers are the connection between lower dimensions and higher dimensions. So we explore the heart doctrine and the zero-point studies and other aspects of mystical teachings, such as the concept that this is an ancient mystical formula in the sense that one is divided by 1, 3, 7. And that, in a way, the first one and the denominator is the absolute, the kind of infinite principle that pre-exists before the creation of our cosmos or universe. And then under in the denominator, you first have one, and that the idea that ultimately everything in the created world is unified. And then you have the three. And in the Vedas, that would be called the three modes of nature, sattva, rajas, and tamas. And they stand for three principles, meaning intelligence, energy, and matter. And that all three, anything in creation has a triune nature. It has an intellectual, energetic, and material aspect to it. Okay, and then those are called the three modes of nature. Okay, and then in Kabbalah, you could talk about the three pillars. Okay, and then you have the seven. And the seven in mystical teachings in Blavatsky, both hyperspace is seven dimensional. Like what she calls the eternal parent space is seven dimensional. And then when creation happens, Blavatsky in the stanzas, it says seven inside, seven outside. Okay, so the idea is that when creation occurs out of apparent nothingness, that the seven inside are then manifest outside. So this suggests, firstly, that kind of hyperspace is seven-dimensional, and then when creation happens, it will create seven realms of reality, or seven planes of existence on different vibrational levels, and that the universe has this sevenfold or octave structure inherent to it. And this was all pre-existent in non-existence before creation happened. So we tried to explore the meaning of such concepts as these, like about these ancient spiritual teachings about the nature of existence, how the one becomes three and seven. And that's in Kabbalistic teachings, and it's in the Vedas, and it's in Gurdjieff and other sources. Okay, and we also, lastly, we often have guests on who are activists, and we explore a wide variety of issues pertaining to what's happening in our society at this very kind of critical juncture in human history. So we at times have more political flavor. But we have been promising to do a series of shows on Beelzebub's Tales, which is a classic and ultra-fantastic book, which is relatively unknown in the modern world. That will be the main objective today, will be to begin to explore Beelzebub's Tales. I thank BBS Radio so much for hosting this show, and do encourage people, look at my website, and there are links there that you can look at. All of my four of my books now are available through Amazon. So I'd like to bring on my guest, James Moffat from Toronto, Ontario. Hi, Jim. How are you?
Good. How are you, Chris?
Yeah, good. So, a couple of things. Did you have any thoughts for today? Or
I haven't had a thought for so long, I can't even remember.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just thinking, I was trying to think of where we were, because, with Christmas, and I was sick, and I didn't make the Christmas show, and then we had a more of a political show last time. So we kind of, it's been a while since we were sort of talking. We were going through the definitions of psychology, I believe, through from your book Psychological Illusions in terms of the basic elements of the fourth way teaching and discussing various aspects of those definitions of psychology and how they pertain to the essential element of the fourth way and the basic tenets of the teaching and sort of it was very interesting discussion, and I'm not even actually sure where we wound up with that. Like I think we got through them, and we made reference, of course, to coming to Beelzebub's tales and discussing it in terms of your book The Slugs, which is a commentary on Beelzebub's tales. But
I think it would be worthwhile, actually, before we go to Beelzebub's tales, to go back to where we were, because
that's what I was going to suggest.
Yeah, and just finish that off a bit, because there were some other things about the Gurdjieff teaching I didn't want to. That it's useful to explain a little bit even before we come to the tales, because then you have more of Gurdjieff's language, I think. Yeah. So that'll be good. We'll go back and we'll pick up some of the issues from Psychological Illusions.
Well, one of the things, just before we do that, which is kind of for people who don't know anything about Gurdjieff and the Fourth Way, which is quite, I think, distinct in terms of his teaching, is the fact that we have Uspensky's book In Search of the Miraculous, which is largely composed of lectures that Gurdjieff gave between the years of roughly 1915 to 1919, in that era. He had come to Russia after traveling for many years in search of knowledge and studying in various esoteric communities and supposedly uncovering this ancient lost teaching, the Fourth Way. And when he appears in Russia, Uspensky was a professional journalist as well as having mathematical knowledge and knowledge of esotericism and mysticism. His book is it comments on Gurdjieff as he appeared as a teacher and various aspects of his relationship with Gurdjieff. But like I said, the body of the work is Uspensky's recall, because they weren't allowed to take notes of these lectures, which is quite amazing. It's a fantastic piece of journalism, actually. And in those lectures, Gurdjieff articulates and provides an exposition of his system, which is it's not straightforward, but it's incredibly articulate and incredibly precise and just an amazing series of lectures on his teaching. And then later, when Gurdjieff, with the Russian Revolution, Gurdjieff and Uspensky both left Russia, and Uspensky went to England and Gurdjieff went to France and formed his institute. And there, in the 1920s, after having a car accident, he decided that he was going to write, which is, he says, is something he never wanted to do. And that the result was three books, the most important of which is Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. And in that book, the way in which Gurdjieff presents his system is completely different from the way that he presented it in Russia a few years earlier. And so it's in terms of the writing, it's often very, he has a very peculiar, very strange style, almost like experimental writing, and it's mythological and it's allegorical, his tale, but within it, you have to work to get to the kernels, but within it, the system is articulated, but it's articulated indirectly, so it's very, very different. I don't know if you know of anything else, Chris, where a teaching it's got such distinct aspects to it, because it's almost like two different people are presenting these ideas. I mean, you see it in two extremely different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I know it's funny, because even Uspensky wouldn't allow his students, I understand, to read Beelzebub's tales, eh?
Yeah, that's right.
Sure,
that's,
he did.
Good point.
Which
yeah,
is he, very odd, you know.
And yeah.
So it shows how much, though, as Uspensky says, that like the system of ideas, he said, like, could be taken independently of Gurdjieff.
Yeah.
In a way, yeah.
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 Yeah,
it's interesting. Gurdjieff traces the teaching back to pre-Egyptian times, but he says a earlier Egyptian time than we know of.
Yeah, pre-Sandy Egypt, I think, is the phrase that he uses, and he says.
Oh yeah, is it?
It was actually even though you know the Egypt is a very ancient civilization as we now know it. He said that there was actually a very highly developed civilization in Egypt prior to that, and that it went much further back. And that I think at one point he says that the Sphinx was actually a copy of something that was done earlier, he alludes at various times to this ancient Egypt and very actually tantalizing references to archaeology and history, which are quite unknown in modern times. One thing when you were saying like when Uspensky went to England, he at first supported Gurdjieff and helped send pupils to his institute, but there was some sort of break which nobody's ever really been able to understand between the two of them. And Uspensky, as you say, when he was reading the drafts of Beelzebub's tales, he just thought he couldn't make hide nor hair of it, and he said at one point that Gurdjieff was the finest lecturer he had ever heard, but he thought that he was much better qualified to provide an exposition of Gurdjieff's ideas. But and in a way that's true. That's you know, there's certainly an aspect of that. It's true. And Uspensky talks all the time about the system, whereas Gurdjieff would, in the words of Madame de Salzman, one of his oldest pupils, he would go for a while teaching in a certain way, and then when he thought people had reached a certain point with it, he would completely change. So he would change the emphasis of his work, and his work was very dynamic. At one point, he took people to Finland when he was still teaching in Russia, and he had them fasting and doing all sorts of sacred gymnastics and exercises and breathing exercises and put them through a very intense training. And that only lasted for a brief period. And then later, he put on a ballet, or he was having people work on a ballet, The Struggle of the Magicians, which he developed, and they worked on all different aspects of the ballet, not just the dancing, but the creation of the costumes and the sets and the lights and everything. And so everything was always with him was very dynamic. It was always changing, and he never settled on any fixed method of presenting his teaching. And so in that sense, like Uspensky's wrong, and when he says that Beelzebub's Tales is a muddle, because it's intentionally written in a very difficult style, and it's intentionally written in an allegorical and a mythological style, because he's not appealing directly to your intellect. Like, I mean, this is a gross oversimplification, but I like to sort of characterize that the teaching as it's presented in Search of the Miraculous is to develop consciousness, and the teaching that's presented in Beelzebub's Tales is to develop conscience. So the one is aimed at the higher intellectual center in fourth way terms, and the second is aimed at higher emotional center in fourth way terms. And the first is to awaken the intellect and to make people think more clearly, and the second is to make them feel more coherently and in a purer sense, even though obviously there are aspects of emotional and intellectual development in both approaches, but it's a very different emphasis. And
Gurdjieff would call it, like, talk sometimes, knowledge versus understanding.
Yes.
And Beelzebub's Tales brings you more to the understanding. Like, it does have that more emotional quality to it. Like, I found that particularly in rereading it this last time, and all his sections on the causes of war and how this terrible process is so strange on that planet Earth, you know. And his kind of caricatures of people and what we're like and society is like and the arts and the politics, and it's like this humorous even and view of the life of humankind.
Oh, it's an incredibly funny book. I mean, it's a very satirical. It's satire at its best, and And at the very beginning in the introduction, he goes to great lengths in kind of the circular way of telling people that essentially everything you think you know is wrong, and not only is what you know wrong, but you don't even know how to think properly. And he goes into this kind of elaborate explanation of why that's so and the need to overcome that. And so that's, in a way, like he's trying to upset and bewilder and baffle you by presenting things, everything in a strange light. And that's why, like, a straight exposition, is, which appears in Search of the Miraculous, isn't at all appropriate to what he's trying to do in this second work in Beelzebub's Tales. And it's clear that it was intentional, because if you read Meetings with Remarkable Men, the second volume in his writing, it's a lovely little book. It's an allegory, and it's mythological, but it's a lovely little book, and it's extremely coherent, extremely well written, and easy to read. So he clearly was trying to do something to intentionally make it difficult for people to understand him in this work. And if you don't get that, then you'll never understand this book. Part of it is kind of, I think it's harder to read the book at the beginning in the first 50 pages or so. The introduction is about 50 pages. As you go along, you sort of get used to his cadence and his peculiar style and everything, and it becomes, I think, easier to understand it. But nothing is ever told to you directly. You have to keep digging all the time to say, what does this mean? Whereas, I mean, things are at least familiar. Even the ideas are strange in Search of the Miraculous, or contrary to what, you know, is established in modern science and psychology. At least they're in terms that don't require any special effort to try to dig at. It's just, you just have to try to understand some different ideas. So, even in that, it's like Gurdjieff is such a remarkable figure that he has the intellectual resources and the knowledge and the understanding to be able to present his teachings in such radically different ways. And I think it's really only when you bring them together that you really grasp the enormity of what he's suggesting and what he's trying to teach.
Yeah, to me, what was most profound about it very early on was that it was the most lucid model of the basic nature of a human being. And there were two things in particular, because I was studying modern psychology at the time and a professor of psychology, but he explained two things which are so important. And one was like that consciousness is something separate from thinking and feeling and sensation, which he would describe as the three main being functions, that we function mentally, emotionally, and physically. So he calls us three-brained beings. And at the time, I could see how all of psychology was dualistic, and they always talked about the mind and the body. But so it made sense. Oh, yeah, no, it's not dual. It's not the mind and the body, or the psyche and the soma. There's the head, heart, and hands, thinking, feeling, and sensation and action as a third aspect. So that was like just so profound, and it was like no one in psychology had that kind of basic insight, you know. So firstly, Gurdjieff distinguished between consciousness and these other psychological functions, and he described those as threefold, that all the way through Beelzebub's Tales, it is the three-brained beings on planet Earth. And that's very significant. So Gurdjieff had these kind of profound ideas about consciousness, and also comparing it to light, and how he explains how we're so conditioned by our past and all our attachments and desires and such that we have very little of this consciousness. In a way, we function like automatons, completely mechanically, and we're controlled by all these stimuli, internal and external. There's no real center in the human being. A human being, in a sense, doesn't have real will, but instead we're controlled by everything. You know, these thoughts and feelings in our stomach and our sexual organs and things happening around us, and we're completely mechanical beings. and we're capable of no independent functioning, in a sense. So it's the state of mechanicalness of humankind. And Gurdjieff says we have to begin self-study by beginning to understand the mechanicalness of oneself. And so, and that's such a fascinating process in the fourth way teaching. And then he says we want to understand like what we can become, but we have to kind of begin by understanding what we are now. And so, and he describes human beings as having major psychological illusions, and that's the name of my book on the, explaining this teaching. That one of the illusions is that we're properly conscious. And Gurdjieff says, no, we're not. Instead, what happens is we form this false consciousness system, which is a function of our conditioning and education and mechanical and unconscious influences around us. So we don't attain to true consciousness. Our essential consciousness, in a way, passes into the unconscious. Okay, so he describes there being a dual consciousness system in people, and that we have to recover our essential consciousness. Actually, I forget what I was saying.
You were talking about the various psychological illusions.
Oh, thank you. So the first was that we're properly conscious, and the second is that we can do, or that we have will. And Gurdjieff kind of explains, really, we don't have, we things get done, but in a way, everything happens. Everything is simply mechanically conditioned. We have no true will that we can actually control our being functions. And function as a whole, as a with a unified presence, that we don't have this development in our being, so we don't have will, true will. And the third is unity of I. Gurdjieff explains, people think we use the word I, and we think we have one central I. And Gurdjieff explains, in a way we do, but and it's there, but in a way, it's on such a different vibrational level that it's not manifested or evident in our inner experience. And instead, a human being can be considered as a multiple of eyes. And he quotes the gospel, which man's name is Legion, that within a person is all these different aspects of yourself. You hate everybody you love everybody you hate, and yeah, all these ideas which aren't our own, and all these, yeah. So the idea then, so in a way, we're always so changeable from moment to moment or hour to hour and forgetful of ourselves. There is no constant I in the person. So again, Gurdjieff says, these illusions of consciousness, will, and unity. And the fourth illusion is that a human being knows himself. And Gurdjieff says that there's like different aspects to knowing ourselves, and it begins studying ourselves in our mechanicalness and as we are. And then the aim of that is to attain knowledge of the self, and he talks about the awakening of the higher emotional center connected to the heart. And he says this is the basis for the experience of self-consciousness. Okay, and yeah. And then he says after that we can attain to levels of objective consciousness, where he says we could know the truth about the world, that we could understand the phenomena in the world and see into the mysteries of creation. To various levels this might occur. So those then are man's psychological illusions. And the idea is if we can overcome our illusions and understand what these illusions are, then we can strive to attain then to a different level of human evolution, according to Gurdjieff. Gurdjieff explains most people are men number one, two, or three, according to whether their physical, emotional, or intellectual nature is most dominant in them. But the idea of a man number four is someone who develops physically, emotionally, and mentally and brings those into a certain alignment and growth in his essence, and then he attains this awakening to the of the higher emotional center and becomes a man number four. And this person is beginning or experiencing true I. In a sense, he knows the truth about himself. Even though in the man number four, that sense of I is said not to be constant. Only in the man number five, the constancy of that singular I is said to be established. So Gurdjieff says there are these seven levels of human evolution. But life mechanically only allows people to be men number one, two, and three. And then it won't happen that you can get to the level of a man number four, because you tend to only sound do, re, mi of your cosmic octave, and you go no further. So Gurdjieff says something special is required to get to the next note in the cosmic octave, which is fa. So I think when I first started studying Gurdjieff, certain insights into psychology, Jim, showed me how valuable the teaching was, like the notions about consciousness and about how consciousness is separate from the psychic functions, and understanding the main functions, the three, and then the seven centers in the Gurdjieff teaching. It's such a lucid model of psychology, and I still don't know anything as comprehensive, at least in normal Western terminology or language. Like some yogic systems, I think, are very complicated, but they're of a different order in a way, whereas Gurdjieff's system is totally attuned to Western language, like how the functions are, you know, thinking, feeling, and moving instinctual. And his use of the words such as consciousness and other words. So very early on, I think I was struck by the intelligence in his writing. I think we both were, and the insights he had into this question of, like, what is I? You know, is I singular? And then when we began to study ourselves, we could see how much we were controlled and absorbed by everything in our lives, and how we couldn't remember ourselves as we went through our lives. And as you start to do that, you start to observing yourself and your own functioning. It was a fascinating process, especially in the first years of it was exhilarating at times, Jim. I think we both felt like so filled with insights and illuminations during that period.
Yeah, exactly. I use a phrase that was sort of like at times that we were seemed to be under this animating state of grace. It felt like a bit like it was twofold in a sense. It's like, on the one hand, it's like, as you say, it's like Gurdjieff depicts the world as like depicts people as being sleepwalkers who are going about in a sleeping world where everything happens, and just that, like, we live in a world where everything happens, where there's no real I, people don't have consciousness, will, unity of their different eyes, and can't do, and people are imprisoned and don't know it, and on the one hand, his teaching urges you to begin to study yourself so that you can understand that this is the case, but at the same time, and you see that, at the same time as you see that, you're also aware of the huge possibilities that could be there for you if you could wake up and be properly conscious. And as you say, as psychology students, I mean, there's nothing in modern psychology that's even remotely like this. And as you say, like, there's this kind of dualistic paradigm that dominates modern psychology. It's psychology is the study of the mind and behavior. It's the study of the mind and the body. It's always construed dualistically. And the idea that with Gurdjieff, with the different centers, like that we act physically, intellectually, and emotionally, but that our consciousness is something separate from the psychic functions, it just creates such a completely different scheme for understanding everything. And nobody in psychology really recognizes or has anything to say about the fact that we're sleepwalkers. I mean, behaviorists say, yes, everything happens in a way, but they formulated it by denying the existence of consciousness. And so they got part of the picture right, but they didn't have the bigger picture right. So this is quite extraordinary to be pointed in this direction. And then, like, the big thing, I think, in addition to what you've said, is that like, Gurdjieff says in order to study consciousness, you have to study yourself and the world, but you have to study it in yourself, and you can't know consciousness in other people. Well, Western psychology and philosophy, that's exactly what they try to do, is they try to study consciousness where it isn't. They don't try to study themselves systematically, and they don't look at themselves, and they don't study themselves in terms of a teaching. And that's what was so different about the fourth way, like, which really stood out. But this idea that we're all asleep was just so extraordinary. And the more we studied ourselves, the more we realized, yes, we are asleep. I remember there was when you were writing your doctoral dissertation, and you had it kept growing as you wrote it, and you were coming to Ottawa where I was living to visit your daughter, and every time you would come, you would bring a few more pages, and I would reread it and reread it, and this is sort of my introduction to the fourth way. And there was a part where you're talking about how we're not normally properly conscious, like that we have a very dim or non-existent sense of ourselves being here, our eye experience, and you said, just as you, the reader, you said that we are normally embedded or absorbed in our thinking, feeling, acting, whatever psychic functions were going on. Our sense of eye was absorbed in these activities. And you said, just as you, the reader, were probably not aware of yourself here reading these pages. Well, every time I'd come to that, I mean, I knew it was coming, and every time I'd come to it, I'd realize that, yeah, I'd been absorbed in reading, and there was no I experience. That you know, I, for all intents and purposes, did not exist. It was just my I was essentially unified with that act of reading and the intellectual activity that went with it. And so, like, to be challenged that way, like in Western psychology, there are two states of consciousness recognized, sleep and the waking state, and there's no further differentiation of the waking state. Nobody really talks about anything above that. Nobody talks about the capacity for going beyond change and actually transforming our level of consciousness. And Gurdjieff says this is precisely what we have to understand, is that all of these things that we attribute to ourselves, we don't possess. We don't have a unity of our identity in the sense of a unified single I. We can't do, we're not awake, and we don't realize that the people around us are not awake. And at the same time, he says, if you begin to study yourselves, you'll recognize that. If you study yourself systematically with these ideas, you'll recognize that in yourself, and then you'll begin to see that even the act of observing yourself and doing what he calls self-remembering begins to change that and begins to give you a glimpse of what it would be like to actually be awake. And that's the part that's completely missing in Western psychology, and which makes it really a pseudoscience from our perspective, is that it doesn't, psychology and Western science don't deal with the fundamental definitive features of normal waking consciousness, which is that it's not a proper consciousness. It's a false consciousness system.
And yeah, what you say is so important about how this psychology was so different, because it was, you applied it to yourself. It became a part of your being, your understanding. Whereas the other psychology, it was all just these kind of different people's theories and ideas that you kind of had to memorize. Like, it was all acquiring this knowledge, but not living experience. And how, and regular psychology, for the most part, completely ignores the very issues that Gurdjieff is talking about, like the issues of consciousness and the issues of what will is, or if man is capable of having will, and the whole concept of unity of I, like the,
Yeah, another aspect of it, too, is that, that what's so important is this to amplify on this idea that, that consciousness isn't the psychic functions, is that Gurdjieff's saying, like, we have these three different distinct brains within ourselves, each of which has its own way of thinking and its own speed of operation. They're all different and a different type of memory, and that these brains are acting within us, but they're not acting in harmony, and they're often opposed to one another, and they're often doing things that aren't appropriate for the type of work that he calls wrong work of the different centers. And in addition to this, is that each center can work with a different degree or level of consciousness. So then you have this incredible matrix of possibilities, is that, well, if you were working intellectually in a more conscious degree or level of consciousness, that would be completely different from sort of mechanical, lowest level of consciousness operating in the intellectual center. And each of the centers can work with a different level and degree of consciousness and for different periods of time. So the possibilities of the interaction of levels of consciousness with each of the centers creates this entire matrix, which shows that our experience is much more varied than we think, and is capable of being much more varied than we think.
Yeah, and how there really are like these different intelligences within us, kind of,
yeah,
all part of one being, like really quite different aspects of ourselves. Yeah, to differentiate those. I mean, normally, everybody experiences those, but they don't have the simple understanding of the differentiation of elements within their own experience. And then Gurdjieff, like he says, not any kind of self-study is valid. He says you have to have a system of knowledge to use in your self-study. And then he provides that with his model of the centers and consciousness. And it's very interesting how each center, he then breaks down further into having an intellectual, emotional, and moving or mechanical aspect to it. And that is related to the quality of attention. So
yeah,
to be in the intellectual side of centers involves conscious attention. To be in the emotional side of centers involves attention which is engaged. Something engages us. And then to be in the mechanical side of centers means activities which can be done unconsciously. So I can be driving a car along and just do it all unconsciously, all mechanically, without even being aware of it. And that can go on while I'm driving along, thinking about what I got to do during the day and having certain feelings about things which are unresolved from the day before and things like that, that we have these different things going on in us simultaneously.
Yeah, yeah. Because
you start studying that, it's fascinating. You start realizing, oh, yeah, like this is moving function, you know, all the things you do in movement and your habits and such. How it can be all go on so mechanically and you're not even aware of it. You can't even stop it.
And most of it, that's such an important distinction, because he talks about how often so much of what people take to be exchange of ideas is really this sort of most perfunctory, habitual, mechanical exchange of ideas, that people have different associations within themselves, and they don't really think about things. They think they're thinking, but basically they're just sort of parroting what they've been conditioned to believe and think. And so, like with your example about the different parts of the centers, it's like, in the intellectual center, you don't, you know, mechanically, you just know that 9 times 9 is 81. You don't want to think about it, or, you know, to be investing energy in it, or that the capital of Greece is Athens. You know, like those are things that you mechanically can recite. But if you're having a conversation and you're trying to convey to people what the essential elements of the fourth way of the teaching of G.I. Gurdjieff are, you want to be actively, consciously thinking of what they are and how to try to best explain them. You don't want to just be sort of repeating things that you've read in a book. And so it requires more of a conscious effort. And the quality of attention required is much more demanding. And that's the problem is that, according to Gurdjieff, is that that's what makes us sleepwalkers, is that we live in such a low level of consciousness that almost everything in us, in terms of our physical activities, our emotional activities, and our intellectual activities, consists of this mechanical, very low level of consciousness and being operating through the different centers, or the centers operating mechanically and unconsciously, and that we need to try to awaken by becoming more conscious in each of these centers and harmonizing them and bringing them into balance. The whole scheme is so complicated that in terms of his explanation of things, but those basic ideas, and then we haven't even really mentioned the idea of self-remembering, which is that the idea, he says, is that you can try to be conscious of yourself being here in this moment, so that you can try to invoke the I experience. You can, by trying to remember yourself. And Uspensky says at one point that real psychology begins when a person is told that they can't remember themselves, but learns that with effort and learns that they can't, but with effort realizes that they could remember themselves. And that's why I say, like, self-remembering is really the most profound psychological experiment in the investigation and trying to understand consciousness. Because if you're told to remember yourself, you'll soon find that you can't remember yourself. And not only you cannot remember yourself, you can't even remember to try to remember yourself.
Which is
the most extraordinary documentation of how asleep we really are. But at the same time, as Uspensky says, you have these moments when you do remember yourself, and they are moments because they don't last very long, and you realize, geez, everything is so dramatically different. That's what you were talking about earlier, like the first few years when we were studying this. It's like, on the one hand, it's all, you realize all the horror of everybody being asleep and living in a sleeping world where nobody realizes that everybody's asleep. But at the same time, you kind of awaken to it, and awakening to that within yourself and within others is an incredibly, as you say, an exhilarating experience. It's an inspirational experience. It's like you're feeding on a more subtle food which nourishes some aspect of you and begins to cultivate the arising of something within you, which I think is what you talked about, that you begin to have a sense of your real I, and that everything could be completely different. It's kind of comparable to taking a psychedelic drug where you realize that your normal sense perceptions of and what you think is real is really a construction based on the level and state of your consciousness, and that really everything could be dramatically different if your consciousness was altered. Well, trying to self-remember alters your consciousness just like taking a drug does, and it reveals worlds that exist within the world that you think that you know and understand normally, but which clearly you do not.
Yeah, it introduces you to a new world. It's an adventure as a process. It's an adventure.
I always like that biblical phrase that I think really captures this, is that you feel like you're a stranger in a strange land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's like you begin to observe yourself and kind of become more and more aware of what goes on in yourself. And in the Gurdjieff work, we struggle against certain things. So, for instance, it's emphasized particularly important is the struggle against negative emotions. And Gurdjieff is explaining that most people through their day all the time are having a series of different negative emotions about all different personal things through their day. and that they carry these with them and relive them and fantasize and imagine about them. He calls it internal considering. So that people most times are always kind of have this turning of the mind going on within them where they internally consider things. And so this becomes, it's an automized pattern of thinking involving mechanical aspect of the thinking center and mechanical aspect of the emotional center. So then Gurdjieff emphasizes that if we can struggle with negative emotions, then all the energies that would go into all these kinds of personal emotions can be retained, which is what we want to do. He says we're always wasting our emotional energies on things that have no real significance. So I found over time, as I began working on myself, that a lot of things, like I'd maybe be irritated about something, but I would much more easily become aware of myself doing it and kind of laugh at myself in the inner world and let it go. So it was like these things that would normally kind of arouse different kinds of negative emotions and internally considering, you become aware of those things earlier and you learn to kind of let them go. And I learned how to work with my breathing, because it's with your breathing you can kind of let things go. And as you reestablish your breath, then it helps disidentify from things. So different, and even of your own thoughts, like you'd see the patterns of your own thinking at times, and you'd look at it like a stranger in a strange land, and kind of look at your own thoughts. How could I have such kind of mean, petty thoughts like that, and attitudes? And you'd see these things in yourself. And it's like Nicole says, he says, like when you begin to wake up, he says, in the light of the kingdom, you begin to ask, have I been insane? Kind of like if you could all see into your inner world all the time. And that's in the fourth way. You begin looking and seeing into your own inner world and your negative emotions and what they're rooted in and how unnecessary they are, and releasing them and learning to be present and awake to the moment instead of always have this turning of the mind and internal considering going on within you. Like people walk down the street, but while they walk down the street, their mind is turning and their emotions and all these habitual thoughts and feelings are going on the whole time they walk down the street. In a way, they're not conscious of walking. They're not conscious of breathing or being alive. They're just caught up in these habitual processes all the time. So we want to kind of break out of that and maintain this heightened consciousness in our moment-to-moment experience. And as you do it, in a way, it's exhilarating because you let different things go. And like as Jim was saying, it's like you're feeding on something. And in a way, that's a very appropriate term, because Gurdjieff describes psychological impressions as the third being food. That there are three being foods: physical food and water, air, and then psychological impressions. And they're a being food, so we can. Gurdjieff says that most people, if we just assimilate psychological impressions mechanically, well, they provide a certain energy to us, but not very much. Whereas if we, when we receive psychological impressions, if we're in the state of self-remembering, well, then it gives us, it doubles the impact of those impressions. And in terms of the food octaves, that's very important, that if you're awake in the moment of receipt of impressions, then it produces the further refinement of energies within your psyche. See, in Gurdjieff's teaching, we want to accumulate more of the finer energies, or hydrogens, as he calls them. Hydrogen meaning it's a generic term indicating, meaning in a sense, substance. So I could talk of hydrogens of different densities, a hydrogen 1 or a hydrogen 5036 or whatever, different densities of substances. So Gurdjieff says there's this alchemical process of interchange that can occur, but we have to stop wastages of energy. And as you start studying yourself, a lot of things, you release them, or things that used to engage your attention, you have no interest in them anymore because they don't have significance to you. So in a way, you begin to accumulate more energies. We want to refine more energies. So actually, self-remember, in a way, it does feed us in a certain way. And as we do it over time, it's like we begin to accumulate more of these energies over time. And Gurdjieff would describe these energies, or higher hydrogens, as actually saturating the other tissues and aspects of our body. And he describes this as an alchemical process of refining. Like in alchemy, the idea of refining gold out of base metals. Well, he's saying similarly, we have certain being foods, and if we can refine those energies produced by those, then we can attain to the gold, which for Gurdjieff would be to attain your higher being bodies, like to develop your higher being bodies, your astral body, which he calls your Kesjan body, and your mental body. And in a way, for Gurdjieff, to develop your higher being bodies is what it means to attain your soul, and through that, to attain your true I. So, yeah, so it's a fascinating process, and one gets an actual inner taste of what we're talking about when one actually does it. Like now, Jim, it's like we're just trying to describe a process, but when you actually do it, like... So often people think to hear the ideas, they equate to doing something, and it's not. It's like people, you know, to try to understand what self-remembering is, you actually have to try to do it. You can't just learn it as an idea and understand it. You have to do it to try to understand it. And as you do it to try to understand it, over time, your understanding of what it is changes. I found that for years, that my understanding of what self-remembering was would be changing.
Yeah, and at one point, I think in Search of Miraculous, Gurdjieff says something to the effect, he's basically that everything in the system has meaning only in relation to the effort expounded to change oneself. And as you say, on an intellectual level, you can discuss and describe these things and people can gain a sense of that, but really, and this is what's most unique, I think, about esoteric teachings in general, and the fourth wave, especially for me, is that everything takes on such, it becomes so dynamic in the sense that it takes on different meanings depending upon your efforts and depending on your experiences and depending on what you've come to understand through your efforts. So, as you say, a basic concept like self-remembering, it takes on an entirely different meaning over the years that you try to do it. And I still don't really understand entirely what self-remembering means, but I know that it's much more complicated than I originally thought. And in some ways, there's nothing complicated about it at all. It's just, you know, it's just having the experience I am here. So it depends on what level you're talking about it. And that goes to Beelzebub's tales, because I think I don't know the exact quote, but there's something to the effect that, and I wish I did know the exact quote, but there's something to the effect where Gurdjieff said in his book, everything had three aspects and seven levels. I think that's what he says, and that's really when you're discussing all of these ideas in the fourth way. Everything is multi. Everything exists in relation to a scale, because nothing is. Nothing is just one thing on one level. It has different levels of meaning and different aspects of meaning. And that's what makes it so fascinating, is because the deeper you go into it, the more you realize the reality of these other aspects of something, even something that you think you understand, over time completely changes in terms of you not only gain a greater intellectual appreciation for it, but you have more understanding because you have more experience in working with it, and you've been able to substantiate it within yourself and within your observations of others and within your discussions with others. And so it takes on this, like, at one point, Uspensky says, like, the fourth way, his experience of the fourth way teaching was unlike any other set of ideas. It was more like being in communion with some sort of an organic intelligence. And I mean, in a way, that sounds kind of fantastic, but that's exactly, I think, the experience that we've had, is that it's like the teaching itself is alive. It's like something dynamic. It's like it's intelligence. It's not just like ideas as we normally understand them. When you were saying earlier about Gurdjieff too, it just reminded me something I wanted to just comment on, was that you were saying that Gurdjieff seemed, the fourth way seems particularly well suited to like modern Western thinkers, and his articulation of his system is, he uses words like consciousness, and it's somehow more accessible. One of the things that he says about the fourth way, and we don't really know what the fourth way is that the fourth way has existed for a very, 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 very long time and had been lost for many years to people. And that he says of the fourth way, it appears at different times for a definite purpose, and that he had adapted the teaching to this time and for a specific purpose. And I think the more I reflect on it, the more I try to grasp what the fourth way is, the more that seems to me to be, that it's not just sort of a throwaway, to, you know, the allusion to something mysterious. I think that's something to really ponder. Why did this teaching appear at this time? Because I'm convinced of its utter uniqueness, and I see its incredible value, and I see its importance in our time. But why did it appear when it did, and why does it take the form that it does? And again, this brings us back to what we were talking about at the beginning. It's like, why did Gurdjieff keep changing his presentation of it? I think that's really interesting that he went through all these different phases in his teaching. And when I say in his teaching, too, that's another aspect of Gurdjieff. It's like, there's the teaching, like the system of ideas, and then there is his teaching, which is him as a person, as a teacher, instructing people. And so he conveyed ideas, but he also taught dancing, and he taught breathing exercises, and he made people work, and he upset people emotionally and challenged them emotionally all the time, and he had people draw on his, what he called his Handblitzoin, which was this energy he said that he got from his astral body, and which he could help other people work with, and so that he had more than he needed for his own purposes, and people could draw on this energy. And I mean, you have people actually describing him transmitting energy to them, and in one case, Uspensky saying that he communicated with them telepathically. So there's all these different aspects of Gurdjieff's teaching, like his active teaching, which are taken together, like from the very beginning that we know about him from Uspensky right through to the end of his life when he was running groups in Paris and working with different groups of people. It's really fascinating to look at this big picture. He is the most extraordinary person, and you get that from his writing and you get that from his lectures, but that's even only part of the whole story. So there's so many different elements to this, excuse me, to this fourth way teaching that as I say, the more I reflect on it and try to understand it, the more I'm kind of baffled and at the same time awed by it all, because it's just so, in my life, it's just been, at 30 years that I've been working with it, it's just been such a source of stimulation and inspiration and a real fount of wisdom, not a metaphorical fount of wisdom, a real fount of wisdom. Like, if I know that if I could incorporate and live my life in terms of these ideas, that I wouldn't be recognizable to myself. Like, I would be somebody quite different. I would be a stranger in a strange land, and that's what I'd like to get to. But I don't think I'm going to get there in this incarnation, but who knows? it may be work for you know, the future.
Different things. There are a couple things I want to come back to, and at one point we were talking about the centers, and I think Gurdjieff describes in most people in life, he says, what happens is that from early childhood and birth, we become conditioned and we form a personality, which then can also become what he calls a false personality. And he distinguishes, most importantly, between what he calls personality and essence. And I think, Jim, that this is the other distinction. Like I talked earlier, we talked about, you know, his ideas about consciousness and the centers and how we have these illusions about ourselves. And there were those aspects. But then this differentiation of personality and essence is, like, so important to the Gurdjieff teaching. And Gurdjieff explains it like, our essence is what we are in our being. Okay, in our being, and our capacities in our being. And so the essence involves the seven centers, because those are aspects of what we are as a mind and in terms of our functioning. So we have capacities for, say, faculties of the mind that we can develop. Okay, but then personality is what, in, he says, in a way, it is not your own. It is taken over from outside of you, okay, through being exposed, watching TV, interacting with other people in your lives, education, all the information and reading in the magazines and news, all this which is acquired from without, all this knowledge. And Gurdjieff would say, you know, and this is important. This is not to demean that this is very important, that we, as we grow, we have to acquire knowledge and information about things and ideas and theories. We learn all this, but it's acquired from without. And most of it in education, he describes as, we learn it by rote. So we only develop what Gurdjieff calls your formatory apparatus, which is the mechanical part of the intellectual center. So this kind of becomes filled with all these, what Gurdjieff would call, wrong ideas and misunderstanding and poor, not understanding language, all the confusion. So we have the babble. And people don't understand each other, and they don't understand themselves, and they have no language for anything. So in Gurdjieff, then, what's important is, he says, we need to develop personality and essence and have them balanced. He says a person, most modern people, he says, culture develops a lot of personality. And not only personality, but then false personality. Like, some aspects of personality are very important and useful, like knowing manners, so you can get along cordially among people, and having a practical knowledge of situations and doing things. But then there's false personality. All the false things acquired from without that we take in as our own and become identified with, and we take them then as our thoughts and our feelings, but it's all been acquired from without. So Gurdjieff sees, as time, when the child is born, they're still in their essence, and it's only as they grow older that the personality forms around the essence. And Gurdjieff says what happens through life is that over time, the personality, acquired self, comes to dominate the essential self, which in the sense goes into the unconscious. Okay. So, or the subconscious. So the center of emotional or experience passes from the, I would say, the higher emotional center into the mind and in the formatory center. And that is part of the formation of false personality, as Gurdjieff, or false ego. And Gurdjieff sees people as, like, primarily egoistic and pursuing their own pleasures and motives and such, controlled by all their own motives. So he sees them, this false egoism crystallizes in them. And people take that false ego to be their true self. But their true consciousness has passed into their unconscious. So then Gurdjieff explains that in the work, what we need to do is become aware of these aspects of our false personality. And in a way, as you become aware of them, they can be dissolved or resolved or broken down or surrendered. Different terms might apply in different instances. But he says, and this first process he describes at times like dying to your old self, like seeing the falsity in yourself and the unnecessary emotions and your imaginations and your self-love and your self-centeredness and things like this that we study in ourselves, how we cannot remember ourselves. So in a way, what we're trying to do is break down the crystallized patterns of false personality in order to get back to the essence. So Gurdjieff says it's like, so we want to break down false personality to give essence chance then to grow further. And we don't want this imbalance in our development. The essence needs to be the master, whereas the false ego, which should be the servant, in a way becomes the master. So we need to shift this, getting back into our essence. And that's partly what self-remembering does, because when you self-remember, all of a sudden you catch yourself and you become aware, say, of all the different thoughts, how you were thinking about an incident that happened to you yesterday when so-and-so said this and that, and you said the other, and how they felt this and you felt that, and how they're an idiot and whatever. But we have all this internal considering about things that have happened to us. And we go around through our lives carrying this with us all the time or being preoccupied with this. So as we start becoming aware of this and letting it go and bringing our attention back to being awake in the moment and breathing and cultivating that presence, being present in the moment. And that begins to shift the balance from false personality, and it allows the essence to grow. And that, for Gurdjieff, it's the growth of essence which is the basis upon which a person can acquire real I. Real I can't be an I based in the mind, in the head, in the many eyes of false personality. You see, false personality is all the many eyes. Real I is related to the higher emotional center. So I think that distinction, Jim, and I remember Uspensky saying, he was writing back in the 1930s or something, and he was saying this is completely unrecognized, this distinction in modern psychological theories. I remember Uspensky saying that, or Gurdjieff may have been saying that. And when I was studying psychology, I realized how true that was. No one had that kind of distinction, like between what we acquire from without versus what is really like our own nature and the development of our own nature.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting distinction. It's like when Gurdjieff says that in most people, essence develops until about the age of six, and then it basically stops because personality grows over it like a crust or a shell, because we become so filled up with things through our socialization, and you say all the different sources of socialization and education that we acquire all these things that aren't really our own, and there's no way that essence can develop and grow. And he says that it's not uncommon for a sophisticated, cultured person even to have the essence of a child. And I mean, if you look at people in the world, if you look at the President of the United States, I mean, you know, then you see, people who are celebrated writers and actors and even scientists, often if you look at them and you get an understanding of who they are, you realize that in many cases they seem to be like very sophisticated, you know, small children. They can be so accomplished in some ways, and they're so weak and so underdeveloped in terms of what's really at the core of them that's what I see in that distinction. I see how that accounts for something that nobody seems to recognize, is that why are all these accomplished people, you know, so lacking in terms of what they really are? And I mean, that's my own question.
In their being,
and then the other side of it was when you were talking earlier about the alchemy, and I was thinking about of transformation. I was thinking about when you read about people's encounters with real teachers and people who really have acquired or attained some sort of self-mastery or higher level of their being, people have this palpable sense that these people are completely different and that they have this higher kind of vibration about them and energy. And these are the things that, you know, drive skeptics crazy if you talk in those terms. But, I mean, these are real things that people observe in people. I mean, in the most in the most dramatic cases, you know, some of the master yogis are said to have had these auras that were visible around them, you know, for miles even, that they emitted this intense light, you know. And I see that, like, sometimes. I remember years ago when we were first interested in this and we were talking about becoming interested in the fourth way and studying it, I remember you were talking about seeing Brezhnev reviewing the guards or something somewhere, and all these Soviet guys were there, and they just looked so dead to you, and you were commenting on that they just seemed to be empty, and I think
soulless.
Just like, yeah. You see it in their eyes, and I often, when I'm seeing these famous people, these politicians and people who have power, I look at them, I just see, like, you know, they're what Gurdjieff would call terrestrial nullities. Despite all their power and their achievements and everything, there's essentially something empty at the root of them. They're like George Bush or Ronald Reagan, you know, like they're 6-year-olds in suits, you know. Like, I mean, if you don't have to be terribly critically minded to you know, read about these people and realize that, like, these aren't developed human beings. These aren't, you know, these aren't real men. These are just little kids who grew up and ended up in positions of power, you know. I see that as a very useful distinction. And then Gurdjieff at one point, I think it's in the book, no, maybe it's in Search of the Miraculous. I was going to say it was in Boyhood with Gurdjieff, but he would experiment with hypnotism and showed people how personality and essence could be separated in people, and gave a demonstration of one young man who had come to their meetings and had struck everybody as being very frivolous, and he hypnotized them, and the guy was very serious, and he said, well, this is his essence speaking, not his personality. And then this other person who was very sophisticated and cultured and was regarded as being a serious person said, I think I'd like some raspberry jam and a couple of other things. And then Gurdjieff said, like, his essence is very underdeveloped. You know, he's got the external shell is highly developed, and he has all the appearance of being a cultured and thoughtful and you know, very intelligent person, but really he's quite empty inside. I think that's something that I think sometimes when you meet people, you get an instinctive feeling about that this person is really either very developed or very underdeveloped. You know, unfortunately, it's more the latter in general. But, you know, sometimes you meet people and you just get this sense of them, and they don't necessarily have any great knowledge or wisdom that they're transmitting to you, or you know, that you gain from them, but you realize there's something essential in them, and that's what it feels like. There's something essential in them that is very developed and different from other people.
Mm-hmm. And your comments on political figures, I mean, we'll come to that when we talk about Beelzebub's comments the Hasnamas individuals.
Yeah.
And how he describes what he calls the power-possessing beings. One of the things he says in Beelzebub's tales is that a person, the way it's kind of all arranged, a person can't become a power-possessing being if they have objective conscience. Because then they would be excluded from that. They couldn't become a power-possessing being then. He's talking about, like, the history of war on Earth and how there were different attempts to eradicate it at different times in human history. And he talks about Ashiashimash, who kind of was able to eradicate war at a certain period on the Earth. But then at that time, like, there were elders, like, who were men who had developed in their being in the true sense, who sat on, were part of this council, who had been able to bring such peace to the earth. But then later, what happened over time is that, you had all these other people coming in with their crystallized egoism and their profit motive and their greed and power-possessing beings. So over time, that's who came to dominate. He talks about the League of Nations. You know, so you have all these power-possessing beings, and he talks about war and how when they think of war, they just say, oh boy, how big, how much money can we make? You know, the stock jugglers, he calls them, and the plutocrats, who want to enslave people. So he has a profound kind of psychology of the aristocrats and plutocrats. He talks about the different kinds of crats, which are the different kind of false personality or different types, the theocrats and the aristocrats. But in a way, what's common to them, or to what he calls Hasnamas individuals, is the lack of objective conscience or being shame.
Well,
these people, Uspensky defines a Hasnamas as someone who doesn't care how much suffering they cause other people.
Yeah.
That's totally what it's like. That's how I see the people who spray people with chemtrails. Like, imagine walking down the street, having a can of aerosol spray and spraying it in everyone's face. Here's some aluminum and barium and strontium for you, okay? And you go down the street spraying that in people's face, eh? I mean, you'd be arrested, as you should be. But people can do it from airplanes all across the country. And whoever would do this, like, they're a Hasnamas. Like, doesn't that person experience objective being shame? Kind of like, don't they have any honor or respect for the earth or for beauty or for nature or for God or for existence? Like, there's something missing in them in terms of their soul life. Hey, that
I heard Tony Blair's testifying at another commission and written about the Iraq War, you know, and I was listening to him testify and I on the radio last night, and that struck me as people, the first time he testified, he never apologized to anything, and this time he mentioned something about about, you know, he regretted the suffering that had been caused, and people in the gallery were yelling, too late, you know, and it's like, yeah, it's like, he had to be told, oh, by the way, you know, you really should apologize for all the people that got killed and all the suffering that you've caused, you know, but I mean, he doesn't feel that, like, I mean,
yeah.
You know,
he doesn't feel that
at all, like, I mean, what's the matter with this guy, like, you know, like, I mean, how devoid of any kind of conscience or any kind of heart would you be to do something? Something like that. Not, I was struck too. Like when I read that President Kennedy, when President Kennedy was presented by the Joint Chiefs of Staff with a plan to start a nuclear war, he walked out of the room and he said, turned to one of his aides and said, "And we call ourselves the human race." Like, he was so disgusted by these guys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think some of our leaders, some of our political leaders, there's still some hope for them. There's still a glimmer of heart and conscience in them. But there's just so many people, like as you say, these power possessing beings that just, you know, they're just sociopaths and psychopaths. I mean, not that there aren't all sorts of sociopaths and psychopaths walking around who don't have power, that, you know, who are also like completely out of it. But it really is it's so disturbing. But again, it goes back to this question of like how people's essence doesn't develop. So something essential in them is kind of missing, and then people get filled up with all this, you know, false personality. That's the whole kind of basis of most modern culture is this, all of this false personality material that people are barraged with from all fronts all the time, creating all these kind of moronic concerns and idiotic and imaginary fantasies and unrealities and you know, sense of importance about things that aren't important, and unwillingness and inability to recognize what is important, what's legitimate. You know, Khrushchev would have been quite appalled, I think, by the status of things today. It was bad enough when he was alive, but I think he would be really appalled if he was around today.
Yeah, he sure would be. Yeah, I mean, that's how he saw it. He saw the modern culture as just creating more and more false personality.
Yeah.
And in Beelzebub's tales, he talks like, especially he says among the actors and actresses, and he talks about representatives of art and as examples, and then all the power-possessing beings. But he saw that as, the modern culture, there's more and more creation of false personality. I think nothing demonstrates false personality so much as when you turn on your television set. And the continual, like all the kinds of shows that glorify all different kinds of negative emotional states people, and violence and fortuitous violence kind of, and how, like, TV, it's like they want to degrade people, and they want to, you know, all the titillation in it, which Khrushchev would all describe as like misuse of sex energy. It's like, you know, turn on your TV. You want to know what misuse of sex energy is? All the titillation you get, and in the humor and all. And Khrushchev talked about newspapers, you know, your favorite newspapers. But
film.
But I think that's certainly true. An example of that, it struck me the other day. In Beelzebub's tales, one of the times he visits the Earth, he comes back to the Earth because one of his observations had been that human beings had kind of invented something new by which someone over here could do a little something to something here, and then a person over there would fall down dead or maimed. Okay, and this was their new contrivance for a kind of reciprocal self-destruction. And what he was describing, in a way, was just like firearms, or a person over here can do this little something, which is like pull this trigger, and a person over there falls down dead or maimed. Okay, and in a way, he's kind of describing it like from an alien intelligence, like seeing it from outside, how insane it is. Oh, that person does that, pulls that. Oh, and that person falls down dead. And what struck me 2 weeks ago or so, I saw a video of this place in Texas where they have these people who sit down, and they had like three big TV screens in front of them and computer and a joystick and everything. And what they were doing from this place in Texas, like they bombed like this truck going along a road. And that was what they were doing in Texas. It was like remote controlling of these, whatever they are, drones or whatever. I don't know exactly, you know. But it was incredible. Like, look at the advancement of that. It's like, you know, you can have video. It's like this person is doing this, but it's a real-life person out there being murdered and always based on lies and doing these criminal things just because you're told. Like, it's like these people, like there's something lacking in their being. Like, I think that's kind of the... Like, Beelzebub's Tales is such a remarkable book, in part for Gurdjieff's views on the nature of war and this processes of reciprocal destruction that run through the life of humankind. And how did the human psyche become so degenerated that this was possible? And that's kind of like what he's trying to get us to see in Beelzebub's Tales.
Yeah, it's funny because it's really as you say, it's like it's so different. And the only work that I know where anybody has even remotely tried to do something like disgusting psychologically like that is I've talked about it before on the program is Henry Miller's "Murder the Murderer," which is his anti-war essay, which he began at the beginning of the Second World War and completed it. It's in two parts after the war. And in there, like Miller talks about the men of goodwill as like being the masters and the evolved beings that have appeared throughout humanity. And he says, you know, they would have nothing to do with the power possessing beings. And he said, you know, they're the only ones who recognize that, who don't feel threatened when they realize that somebody has a different idea from them. And he talks about that. He said all of war and all of this willingness to go out to sacrifice your life for the state, which he says always promises you that things are going to get better and never delivers, is all premised on this idea that somebody else has an idea different from yours. And he said, you know, like, people can't be prodded with bayonets up their rear ends, to fight for most reasons. But if you tell people that they have a different idea, they'll go out and they'll kill willingly, you know.
You just fake something. You fake like 9/11, a complete prod thing.
Automatic. He says it's just automatic, you know. And I mean, he really discusses things psychologically, and it's what he begins at the beginning. He says, "I can see no." He's talking about the Second World War, and he said, you know, this horrible war, and he said, you know, I can see no distinction between Hitler, Roosevelt, Mussolini, or Churchill, you know, and I mean, it's like, wait a minute, you know, like this, you know. Hitler's really bad, you know. It's Stalin. Of course, Stalin was sort of good at that point, according to our perspective. He says, the point he's making is that they're all demanding the same thing. They're all demanding that their citizens, quote, and sacrifice their lives, or worse yet, kill other people, you know, because the other guy thinks differently from them. And then he makes all these kind of commentaries on things and predicts, he says, you know, like the atomic bomb is just the first little present that these people have given us. Do you think they're going to stop there? And he says, it seems unimaginable now, but it's only a matter of time before the heavens themselves are armed. Well, of course, you know, like within 30 years, he was right. You know, the heavens themselves were armed, or, you know, like people want to arm the heavens, you know. And that's, you know, that's where we're going. But the whole point is that he's arguing from things, not from a socio, historical, economic, cultural perspective, which is generally what people argue, not from personality. He's arguing things from essence psychologically. He's saying, like, look, this is what war is. Don't be fooled by all the bullshit that people dress it up in and all the rationalizations they have for killing people. This is what we are. And, you know, he says the first lie is that we always justify ourselves. You know, and he said the men of goodwill would never justify killing anybody else. You know, and that's the great lie, is that, oh, you know, we had to, you know, we have to, you know, and this is Tony Blair, you know, testifying yesterday on the radio. I was like, oh, well, you know, if I hadn't have done this, you know, Saddam would have done this. And I was like, well, but, you know, you completely lied about the whole thing. You know, you're a war criminal,
yeah.
You know, but it's just extraordinary. And as you say, in Beelzebub, you have this explanation from this alien intelligence, this being who's traveling through the solar system and who's observed the planet Earth from his observatory on Mars and has descended to the Earth and has been introduced to the peculiar psyches of the three brain beings of the planet Earth. And you get this otherworldly perspective, but also this otherworldly feeling about, like, you know, like you say, like gunfire or firearms are invented, eh? So something here happens, and then a puff of smoke appears, and then a guy falls down over here, you know, and it, like, the way he describes it's so great, because you really realize, like, oh my God, you know, what an absurd idea, and you know, he helps you disidentify with your usual notion of what you understand about things, and especially
yeah.
about war.
So, okay, so...
Oh, and by the way, at the beginning of the book, in the introduction, that's, in a way, he talks about when he's writing the book about trying to appeal to people, and he talks about the difference between... he doesn't use those terms, but he's talking about the difference between appealing to people's personalities and appealing to their essence, and I think that's part of what he's saying. It's like, look, you can read this book... And you can process it, what I'm saying, through your usual fixed ideas about things. But what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to break that down. I'm trying to appeal to something inside of you, which is not your conditioned ideas about things, and which is more your instinctive understanding of things, or as he says, your subconscious intelligence of things. And you know, what the book is really aiming to do is to cut through all of this surface level of knowledge and understanding, which he says is completely unreal, and to fall on something in you which is real.
And it's amazing. It's an amazing book, because I've read it the different times over the last 35 years maybe ago I began to read it. Not that I've read it that many times through my life, but it's like every time you read it, I find, like, now once you understand it more and you have his cadence, it reads so remarkably.
Yeah.
And it flows so beautifully.
Yeah.
But it's like there's something developed in me now that I can read it in that way, whereas I remember the first time I got through the book, if you had asked me what was that about, like, I would have had no idea it was so peculiar, you know, all the different names and
yeah.
what it was really all about. Like, I was really completely lost, you know.
Well, I just started reading it again today.
Oh, yeah, did you?
I read the first 60 pages, 65 pages, and I couldn't believe how, I mean, at times I stopped and I reread paragraphs because I couldn't follow it, but I couldn't believe how much better I understood it this time. I just seemed to be able to incorporate it so much more easily this time than the last time. And I've only read it once, cover to cover. I've read parts of the book at different times. I've read different chapters. I've actually looked at parts of the book to try to understand certain ideas and how they're presented in the book. But I've really only read it once, so this is only my second time that I'm going to read it cover to cover. So,
yeah.
Very
yeah, I'm very pleased. I should mention to people, I have Psychological Illusions and The Slugs, my book on Beelzebub's tales, are both available through my website or through Amazon. And The Slugs is one of the very few books in the literature existent that attempts to explain Gurdjieff's tales. I mean, there that I'm have come across, I've only seen a collection of papers by one of his students, Bennett, on Beelzebub's tales, and some writings by Knott, I think he was called, Journey Through This World. Jim, was that the name of the book where he has about a 50 or 60 page section on Beelzebub?
He has some material, and he quotes some of Alfred Orridge's commentary. I think that's in Journal of a Pupil, his first book. And then there's Michel Waldberg, the French guy, who which is an English translation.
Oh yeah.
He has some really good material on it. And there's, I know that some woman about maybe 10 years ago, maybe not that long, but I read it in the Gurdjieff International Review. I know somebody's done their doctoral dissertation on Beelzebub's tales, but I don't know if that book is commercially available. I don't think it is, but but
actually,
it's shocking how little there is.
It really is.
And without unbidden, I'll say that I think The Slugs is a very, very interesting commentary, and anybody who's interested in Beelzebub's tales should certainly pick up this book and study it, because it's a very interesting commentary and a very interesting selection of what's in the book. I mean, it's just the beginning. You could go on and write another book. There's just so much in it, but I like the book a lot. It's great. Psychological Illusions is, I would say, probably in the last 40 years, 45 years, there really hasn't been that much put out in terms of books on the fourth way. There certainly have been books, but in terms of exposition to the system, there's been very, very little, and not very much that's very good in my mind, but this is probably the most comprehensive it's definitely the most comprehensive book that I know of that's been published in the last 45, 50 years, because in your book, you deal with both what I would call the Uspensky inversion of the fourth way, which is, as I say, essentially drawn from In Search of the Miraculous and the fourth way, and then you have the material also drawn from Beelzebub's tales, and I think there's been a much more of a... typical emphasis in most of the books that I've read has been on the Uspensky inversion, and I think really Beelzebub's tales has been slighted and has been underrepresented in terms of commentary. And in addition, because you're a psychologist, I think you provide a psychological perspective in terms of modern psychological thought, which is very useful, and which certainly addresses a lot of what's essential in the fourth way. So
it gives you that kind of contrasting perspective on the Gurdjieff teaching.
Yeah.
Because it's not just explaining the Gurdjieff teaching, but it's also kind of saying, like, how this compares to modern psychology.
Yeah, trying to put it in the context of modern
psychology. Yeah, and that really helps. It's a very... The Psychological Illusions, that book goes back 40 years almost.
The
beginning
of
our studies of Gurdjieff. Yeah, it's a very heavy book. It's like a textbook almost.
Yes.
The Slugs, it reads much more easily, and it's fun.
More digestible. I mean, it's nowhere near as long a book to start with, but in Psychological Illusions, as we went through the different definitions from Psychological Illusions, which I think is a very, very interesting way of breaking down the fourth way into its essential elements, and then I think you really deal with it. You deal with both the psychological and the cosmological aspects of the teaching, and the big question about how this provides for a completely different understanding of the nature of consciousness, human consciousness, and what the implications are of the teaching for the study of consciousness. So they're big questions addressed and big it's a big undertaking. I wouldn't want to try to intimidate people and think that it's not understandable, because I think it's quite digestible, but it's very comprehensive. So like, it's not a book that you're going to be able to read and be able to understand just like that. But anybody interested in The Forest Way should definitely read both these books, I would say, and would gain a lot of not just knowledge but understanding of the teaching and of themselves from reading them. They're certainly worth going through multiple times, because there's just so much in them.
Yeah, there really is. And psychological illusions, it's so valuable, because you can begin practicing it as you read the book.
Yeah.
And as you try to understand the concepts, it begins this process of self-study. Like, it's like, you know, sometimes people want, you can't just read through a book and understand it, because you, to attain understanding, you got to kind of read with it and work with it, and you go back and forth from reading to understanding. I mean, we've both done that through, you know, the last period. Like, you know, sometimes you're more into the kind of knowledge side of things, and then you go back and forth, and you have to substantiate that knowledge in your experience. So it's a fascinating book, because it is a very valuable method of self-study that I know of no comparable system that is as complete and kind of comprehensive. Not that I know it, that it's absolutely correct, because I wouldn't even claim that, but I would claim that it is far beyond anything comparable that I know of in modern or ancient literature. It's the kind of most comprehensive system of psychological teaching, you know, and these are, this idea of distinction between personality and essence, this is really important concept, and that's kind of been one of the themes of today, and looking at false personality. That's the main idea about Beelzebub's comment about the strange psyche of the three-brained beings on planet Earth, is that they have this kind of crystallized false self-egoism. And then they have all these qualities of their cunningness and haughtiness and civility and all these arrogance and such, all these qualities unbecoming to three-brained beings that flow from this kind of crystallized egoism. But we'll come back. Next week we'll really just launch. You know, we've kind of covered quite a few bases and picked up on some things from psychological illusions that we hadn't touched upon before, which I'm really pleased we kind of completed that a little bit more. Because the personality essence distinction, and you know, some of the new things we've brought up about working on yourself are very valuable. So next week we'll kind of really launch into explaining the tales and sharing some of that teaching, and then the following week after that, I hope we're going to have a guest on to talk about his book, or the book, Political Ponderology, which is kind of on the psychopathy in political circles. And I haven't read the book yet, but I've received a copy of it. So I thought we'll kind of set the stage for that a little bit. By next week, we'll go into some of Gurdjieff's discussion of the Hasnamas individuals and the power-possessing beings and such, because I think it really gives insights into the world situation at this time. That's what struck me that when I reread the tales of this time, because of my concern about the world situation. And it's like, wow, in a way, Gurdjieff got to the heart of the matter in a way. You know, that there are beings in a way that don't have objective conscience. You know, and there are people who are kind of completely mechanical, you know, and who don't care how much suffering they cause for other people.
Yeah, well, not a recent development, you know. I mean, it's like,
no. Yeah,
whole of human history is full of psychopaths and sociopaths, you know, and just people who were just slaughtered, you know, untold millions, you know, and just like, oh, that's one of his things. He always refers to Alexander the Great as that vainglorious Greek. I love that.
Yeah.
He's really good at deflating all these kind of pretensions people have about the greatness of people because they, you know, conquered some land or, you know, won some war or something. I was like, yeah, he's very good at that. I mean, there's so many other aspects to Beelzebub's tales too, but I'm looking forward. I hope to be able to read the whole book by within the next 2 weeks. So.
Oh yeah. Oh, that'd be excellent. Yeah. Great.
Yeah. As I say, I was stunned when I started reading. I was like, wow, this is just like I'm having a much better time with this than the last time I tried. You know, I was like, yeah. And again, that goes to what we were talking about. Things change in this system and this teaching. And the other thing too is that just quickly to close, one thing is the fourth way is not a teaching that requires people to retreat from the world. And that's part of the appeal, I think, for us as Westerners and as people who live in life and who don't want to go in an ashram or a cloistered community of any sort. It's like, you know, it's a way of being in the world but not of it, is the Sufi expression. And you know, that's the more I see of the world, the more I don't want to be of it. I want to be in it, but I don't want to be of it. And I mean, that, in a way, is kind of talks about, you know, how we have to disidentify with everything and try to realize in our essence what we really are rather than to be attached through our personality. So, you know, and that's the thing about the Gurdjieff teaching is that it's so practical because you can apply it in your day-to-day life, like in everything that you do.
Yeah, and it's fun. Like, it's exciting.
It is.
It's I see, like, the idea of feeding off it. When you go out and you kind of self-remembering, it's like the time is fuller and it's richer.
Yeah.
And it shifts the quality of one's experience as one goes through one's life. When you have periods when you're self-remembering It's like magical in ways how things will happen and coincidental things, and there's a certain magic to it all when
and
then we fall back asleep and we lose it, and, you know, but then we can recover it again. We've just got a couple of minutes here.
Yeah.
I'll just remind people my website's at zeropoint.ca. Did you print out my second article, Jim, from the esotericstudies.net?
No, I haven't had a chance to. I haven't had a chance to do anything like the last couple of weeks. I'm really pleased to have that.
Because that's like a refereed journal, and it's such an excellent article. I'm honored that I got to actually formulate the zero-point hypothesis in a professional journal like that.
Because
I don't know of anything comparable to it.
We should direct people to the Esoteric Quarterly. If you go online, that's what we're talking about. You can access this journal online, and Christopher has a two-part presentation in the last two issues. It's an excellent publication.
Yeah, it is. And I'm working on the third. I was going to do a three-part, and this one was to be on the higher dimensional holographic metaphysics of the human heart. And I realize in a way it's going to be too long, so I hope to divide it into two sections and end up with a four-part series. So I haven't dealt with that yet. But it's been interesting going back and kind of writing something afresh on the holographic paradigm and how all of that applies. Once we get through the Beelzebub's tales, we'll maybe come back and discuss holography at some point, which is something we've not done too much.
Yeah, it's just funny because I was thinking of something along those lines today, just about the whole the holographic paradigm and also the idea of non-locality and what that means in terms of consciousness studies, which I think is a very interesting topic. But that's for another show. So thanks, Chris. I guess we're at the end of here.
We are, Jim.
Thanks to BBS. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Seth. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Okay, and this is Christopher Holmes. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Thanks, BBS, and thank you all. Try to remember yourself. Goodbye.
Bye.